Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 10th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Well, we just went through what some people are calling a U.S. presidential election, with the results being essentially that Barack Obama is still our president, at least for the moment, and the Senate is run by the Democratic Party and the House by the Republican Party, and the nation is heading deeper and deeper into chaos. I think the one thing we learned in this election is how easy it is to manipulate people when they are ignorant of economics, ignorant of science, deprived of classical culture, and dependent largely on a completely controlled mass media. And when the younger generation is hooked to a social media which limits ideas to 140-something characters. The political dialogue on the Twitter is something like Obama cool, Romney square. And it actually was a very large turnout of young voters, 18 to 29, which the 18 to 29 age group was 60% for Obama, the 30 to 44 was 52% for Obama, and then the boomers and the seniors voted against Obama in the majority. But the problem we face now is that most people are not happy with the election, but they don't know what to do. And part of our job at the LaRouche PAC is to cure the ignorance and end the manipulability around popular opinion, ignorant prejudice, and so on. Now, just as an example on how easy it is to divert and manipulate people, the two words we've heard almost incessantly since the end of the election are fiscal cliff. That somehow the fact that we are paying more for whatever we get from government than we're taking in is the greatest crisis that we're facing. And for some reason, the people who push this seem to have lost a fundamental principle of economics, which is that you can increase the total income for a nation by improving productivity and its productive powers. Instead, we're inundated with nonsensical discussion around tax cuts and budget cuts, austerity. The difference between Romney and Obama on this is very small. Both of them want to destroy what's left of the social safety network. But what we're going to focus on in the program today is what I think is a much more profound issue. It's what Lyndon LaRouche has been focused on for the last 50 years. And it's what we might call the physical cliff. That is, that our problem is not a money problem, it's a production problem. It's that we're not producing enough goods, that we're not allocating the credit of society to ensure that we have a growing physical economy that will based on increases in energy flux density, which is the only way to increase the actual wealth to society. Now, this is something Lynn has been talking about, Mr. LaRouche has been talking about all week, going back to the discussion with candidates last Monday, his Tuesday evening discussion with his associates, the post-election analysis on the weekly report, a diplomatic luncheon Thursday, a webcast yesterday. He's talked about forecasting and how you could know that we do not have an economy left. Now, I'm really pleased to be joined on today's program with someone who knows a great deal, probably more than almost anyone else on the planet, about the physical economy of the United States. And that's Marcia Mary Baker, who's the other host of the LaRouche Show when I'm not doing it. But Marcia also is, to use a word Mr. LaRouche doesn't like, an infrastructure expert. So Marcia, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here again. And we'll use infrastructure in the way it ought to be.
Yes. Well, I'm sure we'll clarify that during the course of the program. And then also joining us is someone that our listeners know from her campaign for Congress this year in New Jersey. And hopefully we'll be having a very interesting announcement a little bit later in the program. But we're joined by Diane Sayre. How are you, Diane?
Hi, very well, and still above water.
I was just going to ask if your feet are dry. Now, let me start with Marcia. You have a blockbuster article in the November 9th EIR, Superstorm Sandy, Reality Shock for the Course of the Nation. And in it, in the right up in the front, you make the point that the reality shock is that it demonstrates the end of the pretense that there is a functioning U.S. economy. I'd like to begin by you just explaining what that means, how it is that this demonstrates that point.
Yes, you could almost call it shock number two. Shock number one, I think, in terms of the Northeast states, and in fact all the way westward, 25, 30 states, even down to Florida, we know was Hurricane Sandy, and then a week later in the Northeast, the storm Athena. But shock number two, which hit people very quickly, Diane can say more about it, is that our economy was, the economic conditions in the storm zone were completely vulnerable because of neglect, because of decades and decades of deliberate neglect, to damage, to hurt, to death. And then in the course of the hours and days that have followed, we're almost 2 weeks since the first landfall of Hurricane Sandy on the 29th, there has been a snubbing, a just ignoring, a mockery by the immediate leaders, Obama of the federal government and Christie in New Jersey and Bloomberg, of people's immediate needs, let alone, my goodness, where are we going to get the means for the near future? How are we going to rebuild? So this is the shock that's currently in play right now. And just to summarize quickly, the one way to get a sense of this, other than the misery or the desperation, is look at what you need for modern existence: transportation, clean water, sewerage, lights, heat, cooling. You know, if you take all of these areas in that the greater New York area is 20 million people, and then you get fully into New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania, Connecticut, but this part of the country for transportation was dependent a great deal on mass transit, a great deal on light and heavy rail, that is subways and light and heavy commuter lines. And though a lot of the control switches, a lot of everything that makes that work was underwater and destroyed, a lot of the wind gusts and let alone the water hurt the rolling stock, literally the cars you ride in or the locomotives. And where do you snap your fingers and get the parts to repair or replace all this? It's not as if there's a Home Depot for rail cars in the world anywhere. In fact, it can take a year, it can take 2 years. We don't even we only do some final assembly up in Plattsburgh, New York, of the New Jersey rail cars.
We're also seeing the problem with the power grid, because there are still hundreds of thousands of people without power.
That's it. The transformers, everything you need for that is an issue, including the fact that in many structures, such as the big public housing complexes in the five boroughs of New York City that have 400,000 people in them, I mean, there's 400 or 500 housing complexes, many of their electric systems, the breaker boxes, the circuit systems are in the basement, were flooded, are antiquated, even if there was no flood. Same with the natural gas lines. One of the companies serving New Jersey, I think it's New Jersey Natural Gas, has about 400 significant lines of mains, and they call them laterals. And over half of those were leaky and antiquated even before the storm hit. Then you get into the condition of housing, the fact there's no redundancy. Well,
Marcia,
I just summarized it up. That gives you an idea of the fact that we're in big trouble.
And this is the Marcia's report is available on the Executive Intelligence Weekly EIR. It's the LaRouche Pub website. And I think if you're not subscribing to it, you're not going to be prepared for the future. Now, Marcia, we were talking about this question of forecasting, and I find it interesting that just before the storm hit, everyone on the Weather Channel, CNN, Fox, wherever you turned, they were saying, oh, this is going to be terrible, and we're probably going to lose power. In other words, they knew that the area was unprepared. And yet, obviously, they knew that before the storm. We knew it for the last years. Why do you think we've had this policy of not developing the infrastructure of the nation?
Well, you already referred to that in your opening remarks about the idea of, well, there's different ways you can put it, but it was considered not good business to be investing for the future, to consider it a benefit to society to put in this infrastructure. By that, I mean the whole layering of what we just described.
Right.
And so whether it was, take New York City public housing, Mayor Bloomberg and people before him just stiffed the New York Public Housing Authority of the funding and resources needed to upgrade, because there was no idea, there was no active concept that thousands of people were worth anything. It was all for the New York, all for Wall Street.
You wrote that there had been, I believe, in 2009, a conference on how to develop these storm surge barriers in the areas of Lower Manhattan, the Jersey Shore, that all of this there was on the books, just as we had NWAPA on the books that could have avoided the drought. So it's not as though people don't know that there are policies that are just not being funded.
Right. After the Second World War, there was an outlook that let's roll up our sleeves. We did what we had to in wartime. Now we can go out and do things. And in New England, for example, the various towns had built storm surge barriers after the law was passed in 1958, federal law helping all of this. Providence, Rhode Island, Stamford, Connecticut, New Bedford, Massachusetts. They have barriers of certain kinds. They have gates that vessels can go in and out of, and when necessary, it's shut and keeps the ocean out. This was proposed for New Orleans for decades and never done. It was done in Rotterdam in the Netherlands.
And in the U.S., it's the Army Corps of Engineers that primarily develops these policies as an overall policy.
That was the mission called the Civil Works Deployment of the Army Corps. It has a civil works budget, and they did the New England storm surge barriers and gates. They proposed it and appealed for decades, and you saw what happened because it wasn't done before Katrina. And we should say right here that in the Katrina moment, after George Bush's Katrina moment, all right, and certain political developments following that, there was a miracle funding. It was the exception to the rule, and the Army Corps set the biggest contract in its entire civil works history to the Shaw Group, based in New Orleans, a private contractor. And in 2 years, they built now what's the biggest storm surge barrier and gate system in the world, in Lake Bourne, Lake Pontchartrain, to protect the vulnerable parishes of New Orleans. You don't hear much about that, do you?
But it worked when we had Hurricane Isaac this early fall.
Yes, it was a big celebration. In fact, the mayor and everyone went out, I forget, August 29th or so. The gates were put in place, and it worked perfectly. So in 2009, in New York City, the American Society for Civil Engineers there and others attended a conference, and four big engineering firms, one from Holland that has a lot of experience there with sea barriers, they presented specifics, like take the Verrazano Narrows. Diane can describe this more, but you can look on your map. It has that beautiful bridge, 1964, I think. You could put a barrier there, or you could, another firm proposed a barrier from the Rockaways, the Long Island barrier islands, down to Sandy Point, the New Jersey barrier islands. That's a remarkable several mile long barrier, but in engineering terms, that was feasible. And that's what ought to be done now, as long as we make a revolutionary change in the leadership to get rid of those now governing things, which are leading to death.
Mayor Bloomberg, known as Benito Bloomberg, didn't he say that you can't stop the sea?
Yes, I think he could. He and King Canute have a lot in common.
Yeah. Well, you've been listening to Marcia Mary Baker, who has written this article that you should download and read, The Reality Shock for the Chorus of the Nation. I'd like to bring in Diane Sayre, who was a candidate for the Democratic Party nomination for Congress this year in New Jersey. Diane, you've filed a couple of reports, you and some of your associates, in the last days. Here we are, as Marcia said, it's almost 2 weeks after the initial storm surge. What are the conditions on the ground in some of these areas?
Well, they're absolutely horrible. I mean, just among our own people, our office in northern Jersey, Bergen County, didn't get electricity until 2 days ago. So we were without power for about 8 days. And most of my coworkers' homes were without power. And in fact, one of them still is without power. And that's not the worst of it, but I'll tell you the impact of getting hit with the storm. The cell phone towers had been knocked out, so we couldn't use our cell phones to communicate. The other lines were down, and then all the gas stations went out because they now use, you know, it's all electric pumps. So it's, for one thing, you suddenly realize all these things that you took for granted, like putting gas in your car, making a phone call, telling someone what you're doing, were all wiped out in one fell swoop. And then gradually you were able to at least text on a cell phone, even if you couldn't make a phone call. The office, we could not use the water, could not flush the toilets, so we couldn't occupy that. And as I said, most of that is back now, but there are areas like the shore, which were much harder hit, and there are pockets everywhere which, for reasons of flooding, they have not been able to get the power back on. Then we had a call 2 nights ago with a bunch of our activists from the area, and you just get a sense of the magnitude of the dislocation. For example, we have a number of public school teachers in New York who are describing the fact that a number of the teachers in each school have lost their homes, have lost everything, but that you also had in one school 75 students who are now homeless, who lost their homes. You have 75 students living with relatives or friends, sleeping on someone's floor, coming to school in a total crisis. It's a completely unworkable, unstable situation. And then you also have the light rail in New Jersey, various of the transit lines into New York. Right now, I believe the only one that's operational is the PATH out of Newark. So people are trying to get their friends to drive them, and you can only get gas depending on what your license plate number is, even or odd, because there's gas rationing. So if you can get the gas, you drive to Newark, and it's a total mess, total traffic jam. The Penn Station in Newark is not set up for tens of thousands of commuters to New York to drive in. So what you have in the wake of this is really catastrophic. And we don't know how many people are dying because you have these apartment buildings, which are still dark, still no running water. And because you have long corridors with no windows, the residents are terrified to open their doors or come out. So we don't even really know the magnitude of the number of people currently dying, starving, freezing. That's actually the situation here right now.
Well, then let's take a look quickly at the political side of this, because this is something that everyone in the country saw. Obama in the Situation Room, Obama showing up to view the situation, saying we're going to do something about this, and then being embraced by the, I guess Marcia politely called him, the oversized governor of New Jersey, Governor Christie. But you had the two of them saying, don't worry, we're in charge here. And are we beginning to see a blowback on that, Diane? Because it's clear that for a significant portion of the residents in New Jersey who were hard hit, they were promised something that wasn't delivered.
Yes, there is a blowback. And also, people are furious. Their view is that Christie was in part responsible for Obama's reelection, because it gave Obama the opportunity to pull a big publicity stunt. And he, like a kid who's impressed with royalty or something, is blubbering on the news about how the president's been here, and he told me I can call him anytime, and he's really on it. And then, of course, Bloomberg came out and endorsed Obama, saying that he was going to support Obama because Obama recognizes what's really important in a moment like this, which is gay marriage and that climate change and man-made climate change. Heaven forbid we should have a space program and actually figure out where it comes from. So it really is sick. It's like a trio of witches from some Mozart opera or Macbeth.
But Diane, you were not surprised at all to see Christie's embrace of Obama, because this is something that you brought up at the very beginning of your campaign.
That's right, exactly. I mean, I knew from, because first of all, Christie has never attacked Obama, but second of all, they agree. They agree on green energy, windmills and solar panels. They agree in their opposition to Glass-Steagall. They agree in their assault on the union, particularly the teachers' union. So there really is no difference between the two of them in terms of policy, and that was clear, you know, as from the minute Christie got into office, frankly, and Obama.
So I guess now is the appropriate time for you to announce to our audience what you've decided to do about this.
Yes, I've decided that I'm going to be running. I'm going to be challenging Governor Christie for his seat, and I'm challenging him in the November general elections. I'll be running for governor in the state of New Jersey.
November 2013.
Correct.
And that's a big seat if Christie can
see it. I thought that too. Boy, you're gonna
talk about infrastructure. I mean, how many forests have to be brought down to build a chair that'll hold him? Well, this is going to be important because we're now at a point, as President Obama announced yesterday from the Rose Garden, of brutal austerity. And Marcia, I'd like to come back to you. When you look at this sophistry that we don't have money because of the deficit and therefore we're just going to have to take a risk, this really is going to kill people, isn't it?
Yes, and let's speak again in terms of the storm. We can do it otherwise generally, even if the storm hadn't hit. But if you look at the if you step back, and fortunately we had some satellites still working and so forth, and we knew it was coming days in advance. What would you do once the land where it made landfall was clear? You knew that all the barrier islands, that's part of the geomorphology of the East Coast and the Atlantic. You had all those New Jersey barrier islands all along Long Island. So those people were going to be underwater, and some of them are big mansions, some of them are little bungalows, some people have means, some people don't, but they were all going to be underwater. So you could have added up how many of those people there would be and make arrangements for them. Similarly, you know how many of the big apartment buildings are owned by the public housing, low-income housing, that can be 10 and 15 stories high in the New York boroughs and low-lying areas, the Rockaways or Coney Island or something. You'd add all that up. You would know about Staten Island. So you would get a head count, just the way, remember, when the earthquake in 2010 hit in Port-au-Prince. You knew how many people were there, and they were going to be in need. And what take a flashback in time to Haiti. There were those who proposed to the White House, okay, this is a military question. We should send in the Navy, send in the hospital ships, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Army forces to have really decent interim camps on high ground. We got to do this. And Obama said, no, nothing, zero, zip. And within a few months, everything of the U.S. was gone. And within another few months, cholera broke out and worse, and it has continued in Haiti. Well, here, none of what I just described was done because you would have, there was evacuation notices, okay, but you would have set up stations. You would have the inland people too, the inland counties that get the runoff from the rains, even if they don't get storm surge from the sea, you would have had a head count there too. And you would have had camps. Now, the point is that what's well known among military logistics people is find a place. Sports complexes are very good. The one just opened up in Brooklyn in September. It's undercover. It can accommodate 19,000 people. Ironically, it's called Barclays Center, and it's for the basketball team, the Nets. It used to be New Jersey Nets. It's now the Brooklyn Nets. That's within miles of some 15,000 people in the Rockaways that are still in these hellish conditions.
But then you'd interfere with the National Basketball Association season, Marcia.
That's right. Or otherwise, I think today they have the comedian, Russell Peters. So you'd interfere with that, right? So you'd interfere with the markets. So I was just getting a little literal about all of this because a military-style approach, which would be basically federal in collaboration with the first responders in New Jersey and New York and Connecticut, could have dealt with the immediate situation, should be doing it today. We're rattling all the cages. They should, you know, that's what we're here on the earth for.
Well, Marcia, let me ask you this, because we see the politicians hide behind the deficit. We don't have money. But there are competent people who know what they're doing and make these proposals. Why is it that they have no voice? I think this is an important thing for our listeners, that you have people who, based on forecasts that they've made, know what the worst-case scenario is, know what's needed. But it doesn't seem as though there's a constituency for them, even though the whole nation is their constituents in reality.
Well, I'll say, as you say, there are people in the engineering echelons, in the farm and food chain echelons, all along the line, especially water infrastructure, you name it. But it's those individuals are on the hot seat. That what are they going to do to go out and not just lobby, but politically intervene? Along with the LaRouche Political Action Committee agenda, that we have to have the policy shift changes, the credit changes dependent on getting Glass-Steagall back in so that we have real banking, not casino banking. Mm-hmm. And we have to do that kind of thing. Now, the mustering, the mobilization, the call to arms can take place and is taking place very quickly. It's like suddenly, even though it was a year ago, Harley, that in New Orleans there was a ceremony. It was, 18 months ago that the new big $14 billion huge levee and storm surge protection system was pretty, certain elements of it were completed. The Lake Bourne barrier was completed. And that was all blacked out. But there are a lot of people associated with that here and internationally, just like the ones in 2009 that made the proposal in New York. And they come together, and they're a force that will create the future.
But Marcia, outside of what we're reporting on this, I haven't seen the New York Times or the New York Post or the Daily News or any of the media networks that are based in New York City cover the fact that this conference took place and that these capabilities exist.
That's right. I think that that's why the New York Times deserves New York slimes. That's what happens in a flood.
This brings me back to Diane and the question of the political side of this thing. Obviously, Diane, you were involved in your campaign in speaking before labor organizations, veterans groups, independent organizations, farmers, across the gamut. And you brought these issues to their attention. It would seem that these would be people who would be natural for joining your campaign, and yet we saw the disgrace of the labor movement going out and getting the vote out for Obama one day, and then the next day demonstrating against him because they know he's going with his fascist austerity policy. So I assume you're going to have to figure out a means of communicating to these guys that they have to stop being such idiots.
That's for sure. I mean, you would think the labor guys would have been a little smarter because they had the ugly experience last summer where the leadership of the Democratic Party sold them out and cut a deal with Governor Christie to eliminate collective bargaining on the state employees' health care plans. And in fact, they even organized a mock New Orleans funeral with a hearse calling for the deaths of the Democratic, I mean, they said the Democratic Party's dead if you don't have the Democrats defending labor. And then, of course, they turn around. There were some groups that wanted to petition to get the Democratic speakers removed from their post as speaker, but that fizzled out, and they turned around and went with Obama, which is why, at this point, I am going to be running, actually, as an independent, because the Democratic Party doesn't represent the constituents that FDR brought into the party. And labor did recognize that in some degree. For the first time that I know of, the AFL-CIO statewide convention in New Jersey ended up endorsing two Republican candidates for U.S. Congress. So they really have a sense there is no, you know, they're not being represented. There are no jobs. And then they have this foolish thing. Well, we have to go with the lesser of two evils. We can only think along trend lines. We have to play by the rules. Of course, what you really have at the top of this is Tony Blair, the British Empire policy of environmentalism and depopulation. And that's where you really see the identity of Bloomberg, Christie, and Obama. They all agree on green and depopulation, if not stated by their act.
They're somewhat androgynous in their outlook. Well, you know, I think the other point is that what Lyndon LaRouche has been emphasizing, especially on these Monday candidate discussions with you and your other colleagues, is that we've got to break with this party system where you see that the incestuous nature of it was very visible with the Obama-Christie embrace. But in effect, they both are operating within this framework shaped by the so-called fiscal cliff, and we can't afford anything. And, you know, I know, again, that if you look at the ability to break out of this, it's going to require something like this kind of crisis. Now, the question is, how do we move quickly so that we can create within the population that has just gone through this, how do we get them to start thinking differently, the way LaRouche has been talking recently with his discussion of forecasting, what it means to be a human being? I think the main way is that you put forward a proposal for a national mission. Diane, I'd like to hear from you on this, and then also from Marcia.
Well, I can say here what I found fascinating was we've had a pattern in the field in the wake of this ridiculous election. It's almost like a manhole cover being lifted off of people's heads, because we're out there with the LaRouche PAC three-step platform, the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, a credit system, and the WAPA 21, and then also the Strategic Defense of Earth. And we've had a number of occasions where the person coming up to the table is really interested in the WAPA, and they'll say something like, you know, that is a really great idea, but what about the rest of the planet? Which is not the kind of question we had going into the election. But it's interesting that you see once this stupid display of, you know, bipartisan stupidity is behind us, people are gut-wrenched by the crisis. And when they see that we have a solution, they actually don't want a simple explanation. They want to be able to think profoundly. And I've been quite struck by that, where people saying the WAPA isn't big enough. What about the whole world? I mean, this is really different.
Well, Marcia, and of course, you know that something like a hurricane creates photo ops, something that's visible. But the other thing you've been tracking relentlessly is the coming food shortages, which is also part of this physical cliff. And that's something that maybe people see when they get shocked at the grocery store and they see the price of one of their favorite products has gone way up. But in terms of a general day-to-day awareness, it's not there, is it?
Well, I was, when you ask about what do we do, people getting shocked into reality, and you mentioned national mission, I was thinking of a small group of our population which are the people who produce food, farmers. You know, that's very few people. But they are also the people that, the way our system has worked out, they end up going to the grocery store for most of their daily food too, okay, because they specialize. But let me just give you one idea, like what Diane was just speaking of with unionized labor or something. A lot of farmers a few years ago went along to get along with growing corn for ethanol, which was this hideous international green Tony Blair policy and biofuels policy under the false name of saying it's an alternative fuel, it will cause less emissions and save Mother Earth from overheating, and it will make us energy independent, all this BS. But the thing is, a lot of the farmers being demoralized, pessimistic, who actually wanted nuclear power and had been sane, thought there's no way they'd ever get the federal government supporting a price that farmers could continue to produce under for what they produce. So they went along. They started growing unbelievable amounts of corn, and unbelievable amounts have gone into the distilleries to produce ethanol. Last year was the first time in our history that more of the corn that was produced in the Midwest went into the gas tank than fed animals, the chickens, the hogs, the cattle, what we need. So, but you know, now there is a wave of hit by reality of just the need for food, or the fact that in the same county, people who grow exclusively corn might be getting a certain amount of money, but all their neighbors who are feeding hogs are going to go under and losing money. The dairy farmers in California can't feed the cows. There is tumult. There's tumult everywhere. This is a constituency that in numbers is very small in the country, but in potential leadership coming forward, individuals among them, like the individuals in labor that Diane was talking about, beginning to think and having the guts to act, we have a good chance. That's what we're going for. And you see a shift, a potential shift.
Well, it's also the fact that everybody eats. And, you know, we have this situation which was highlighted by Romney, although he didn't have anything to do with it. But the fact that we've gone from 32 million people needing food stamps to have an adequate diet, barely adequate, to 47 million. And if what you're forecasting on food production and the picture we're getting, many of those 47 million are going to have to eat the food stamps because there's not going to be any food to purchase with them. How serious is this food crisis right now? And isn't this really the same kind of question that we took up on the hurricane, that the warning signs are all there, but people are not responding?
That's exactly it. The shock number one, remember we were saying, and Mr. LaRouche used that too, was the hurricane, as Diane's describing this. But the hyperactive weather patterns, you could say, that's behind the hurricane or behind these early snows in central New Jersey, Central Park, this is the earliest amount and date of snow on record in some of those places this past week. The same kinds of weather extremes you're seeing in this prolonged drought east of the Great American Desert, and you have dry soils in other places, into Illinois, into the Midwest, that normally average out rainfall year to year to year. You've had another very dry year in the big grain belt over in Eurasia, in Russia and Ukraine, that area, where you had a bad dry year 2 years ago. So you have certain patterns. And since, because of the British imperial kind of neo-British East India Company policy of one world globalist food supply in the last 40 years, since there has been no buildup of food reserves allowed, no buildup of defensive infrastructure of irrigation so that you can save water from a wet year and use it in a dry year or move it on your continent, that we are getting worse and worse into absolute food shortages. We talked a lot about corn. Some of the people listening to the show, I think they saw their TV this summer, the damage to the corn crops. Well, the winter wheat now, the seeds have been put in the ground in most places. You plant it in the fall, and you need some moisture to germinate out in Oklahoma, eastern Colorado, Nebraska, and it's not there. Some of that germination won't take place, so the wheat won't overwinter, and it won't be there this spring. And the same thing is reported from Russia this week. So there you talk about corn, wheat. Then you don't have the means to feed the meat animals. So I'm not talking about money here. I'm talking about numbers of meat animals are being culled because the farmers in this system we're describing cannot keep them. And the federal government and the state governments too, but the federal government under Obama and the international institutions in the sway of London and the Tony Blair regime, they won't do anything about it.
In fact, the Obama administration is saying that the markets are actually acting appropriately by letting the prices go up.
Yeah, they say it's called rationing demand, namely, if it's too expensive, the people who don't have any means to buy it won't buy it. Too bad, so sad, they can die. And just what you said, that the markets are functioning to ration demand by price, was a statement issued by the Obama administration in October in Rome, where the UN food agencies are. And this, just the same way that Obama also will not lift the mandate for so much biofuels to go into your gas tanks every year, which really sucks in corn. So that's where they stand.
So, and again, this gets at the same question, that you have a population that's going to be hit by one shock after another, whether it's from these so-called natural disasters or whether it's man-made disasters, like having a completely incompetent agricultural policy or a manufacturing policy where we, as you said, to replace the subway system, we're going to give jobs to people in Canada or Japan or China because we don't have any more of these kinds of manufacturing concerns. So this gets back to the fact that the American people don't know a damn thing about economics, and that's how they're played by things such as the fiscal cliff and the fear of the deficit and so on. Now, Diane, you have a regular group that meets in New York City as part of the organizing drive. I know there was a period of time where we had economics classes there, and as a result of it, you have a number of people, including teachers and firefighters and others, who actually now are taking up the responsibility of educating people. How do you see this as, I mean, this is obviously the way we've got to go, but it's got to be done quickly.
Yeah, well, also as New Yorkers, these people are quite aggressive and outspoken, so they've been extremely effective. We got the UFT, the AFT, I think both passing resolutions in support of passing the Glass-Steagall Act. And they're also going after their congressman now on the question of impeachment of Obama. And they're calling everybody in the country, also because many of them are in the teachers' union, they have access to that as an organization and can be heard. So it's an extremely active, very articulate group who did a lot to get some of the original co-sponsors on the Glass-Steagall Act of the 84-85 that we have right now, and they're escalating.
So we have, I think, a constituency in the population that would support these policies. And yet we just saw an election where the total number of people who voted declined by 8 million over the numbers who voted in 2008. And as I said earlier, most of the people who voted were not happy. Now, Marcia, obviously, we can't afford too many more of these kinds of shocks to wake people up, can we?
No, and I suppose we could scare ourselves, but I mean, in the best sense, to remind us that there can be shocks elsewhere. You know, the Pacific Ring of Fire, the earthquake and volcanic zone it gets active and less active at different times. But right now there's been quite a lot of activity on the Pacific coast of the Americas. That is from Alaska off the shore, usually Alaska, British Columbia,
right,
and so forth down to Central America. And who's to say, as it came up in one of Mr. LaRouche's Friday project webcasts, that you wouldn't have another situation like this. So the only response is reality, right? And then the mission to resume a science-based approach to get busy and go to work and put in these policies, as Diane was just describing, the new bank and Glass-Steagall arrangements for the credit and being able to get projects done. And then things can be figured out. I mean, I'm only saying the obvious, but this New Orleans surge barrier, the contract was let by the Army Corps of Engineers Civil Works Division, or first designed in 2006. And then the contract was let to a local but big contractor. And do you know it was done for the Lake Bourne surge barrier by 2010? That didn't take 30 years. And it's a gigantic project. So the same thing with taking care of these thousands of people that are still, after nearly 2 weeks, in the New York public housing in the low-lying areas. You, when you move on something, you can figure out on an emergency basis how to do it. It is entirely the intent, as opposed to the depopulation intent that's behind the greeniness.
Now, Diane, one of the things that this comes back to is, Marcia mentioned this, the question of science. But what Mr. LaRouche has been emphasizing is that we've got to have a revival of classical science and classical culture. And in your campaign, you had several interventions using music, including a classical concert. Just give the listeners of our show an understanding of how classical culture fits in with figuring out that we're not prepared for these kinds of crises and we've got to do something to change.
Well, I think the first example is an inversion, which is he talks about the mind-destroying qualities of rock music. So one of the things that really caused Governor Christie to fawn over Obama is apparently Barack Obama was on the phone with Bruce Springsteen and handed the phone to Governor Christie, who apparently said that he was so moved by getting to talk to Springsteen that he went home and cried, which may have caused another flood, I'm not sure. But at any rate, I mean, so you see the inverse, the stupidity of this mind-deadening thump, thump, thump type of music, whereas what you have with classical culture is it's a challenge to your senses, because what you realize when you're anticipating, for example, what Bach is going to do in one of his fugues, is that you're hearing the unheard. You're anticipating something which has not yet been perceived by your senses. And it stimulates a certain kind of creativity and ennobles people. And we did do a lot of music throughout my campaign. We had choral music almost at the beginning of every event. We did a concert. We're planning right now a concert just of our low. It's not a campaign event, but we're going to be doing the Bach Magnificat on Beethoven's birthday coming up here. It is very important. And also through the classical music, you catch people off guard because there's still a lot of people out there who love it and they don't have much of an opportunity to partake of live classical music. And it kind of is like a flank to come around behind and surprise them and recruit them.
And I think this is something that gets outside of the so-called practical politics, because I heard some Republicans excusing Christie, for example, for his embrace of Obama by saying, well, you know, he does have to have a relationship with Obama so that he can get aid for New Jersey. That's the kind of practical pragmatism that LaRouche rails at all the time. And it is through classical culture that you actually are lifted out of the expected or the mathematical, statistical approach to thinking. And Marcia, I know you have some thoughts on that also, given that you have devoted a life to bringing classical culture to people.
Yes, you're right about being stuck otherwise in people controlling your passions. I mean, figuring that passion and emotions are entirely connected with intellectual, with so-called the intellect side of creativity, if you're just subject to the Hallmark cards formulations of, as poor Diane's probably heard too much of this from Bloomberg and Christie, I've watched it a lot too, people are helping people, we're here for you, we stand by you, we will always be with you. And meantime, let me just switch gears a little, Harley, before the end of the hour, and just say, for sure, the practical is so impractical in the storm zone that the Obama and company have sent next to nothing. It is true, we have some over 7,000 National Guard, and they're doing a wonderful job. And the FEMA staff on the ground are doing a job. And the volunteers and the Red Cross. But nowhere near the military scale might that we could have. We put in the same EIR that you just mentioned, Harley. It's EIR online. Its cover date is November 9th. What Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in 1938, a short description when a terrible storm hit the Ohio Valley region, and he sent in a couple hundred thousand Works Projects Administration workers. So if we had that throughout the counties and the islands and everywhere in Sandy Storm Zone region, we'd have lost some lives, we'd have suffering, we'd have damage. But that's the difference. So the poor public who then suffers physically, but then the mental and psychological impairment from having their formulations all prepackaged about how Obama looked presidential and all this crap. That's what classical, that to me, I endorse everything Diane said 1,000 times about the role when you hear some wonderful music, honestly done, as the composer might want, then you're somebody else and you don't fall for that crap.
And this goes directly at the, I really do think, the way people are manipulated into the silly kinds of discussions that occurred during this campaign, literally with nonstop, funded by $6 billion of money to literally drive the American people either crazy or just lower their IQs. And so I want to come back to the, we have about 9 minutes, a little less than that to go, to the question then of what do we do now? We have on the one side the programmatic side, the LaRouche three-point program, Glass-Steagall to end the bailouts, a credit policy to generate new infusions of credit into physical production, and then NWAPA as a driver. How do we get there? What are we going to do? Diane, you've got your campaign. You've been working with people around the country and a campaign, a candidates movement. How do we get this thing going?
Well, as ironic as it may seem, but it's on this question of not being practical, what we really have to take up is a much greater mission, which is the mankind's mastery of that space between Venus and Mars, which the Curiosity rover gives us a hint, a first tantalizing hint of, because we do have a very real threat with asteroids. And even a not-so-big one, I guess 30 meters across or so, was the one that hit in Tunguska, Siberia in 1908. That would take out an area of, like, the greater New York metropolitan area or the greater San Francisco Bay Area. And statistically, to hate to use that word now, those type of asteroids can hit us once per century, so we're about due. So if you had mankind actually contemplating addressing as mankind, human beings on the planet, instead of these silly British orchestrated conflicts, that we actually better get on the ball and figure out how to solve this. And of course, New Jersey is where you had Albert Einstein doing his work, which is going to be crucial in terms of mastering these things. You used to have the Princeton Tokamak fusion reactor, which I guess is defunded, but you have a certain capacity. Here you have it on the West Coast at Lawrence Livermore Labs and so on, the question of fusion. That's what we're really going to have to mobilize people around. And I think that's why, for example, Keisha Rogers in Texas got such phenomenal support for her campaign there, because people saw her embodying a much bigger fight. We're not going to do it step by step from where we are now, that would be like saying, well, let's solve it by building a million more solar panels, which is not the way to go.
Well, and for our listeners who don't know this, Keisha did receive almost 80,000 votes. It was about 32% of the vote, and she was running with the Republican Party and the Democratic Party attacking her. So, in a sense, she was already an example of this post-partisan or non-partisan approach. Now, Marcia, do you know of any hearings coming up or any legislation or anything at all, or are people just going to sit back and let it just assume this is the way things work?
It's funny. As people may know, Congress comes back this week, and without discussing their intended agenda, the agenda of reality would say we should be doing something yesterday. But I looked an hour or two ago, Harley, just before the show, and didn't see anything. Schumer in New York, different individuals have come out and stood amidst the rubble and said various things.
And they got their ears whacked by some of their angry constituents.
That's right. So I think also that the scale of this, and I mentioned the shock of the storm, but the shock of the lack of no economy and no emergency help on the scale that anyone would presume we should have, has meant that the business as usual congressmen with a pretense aren't doing it. But it's up to us. I know this is towards the end of our discussion, but everything that we've been saying, now is the time. And, you know, Diane, what you just said about you have your thoughts and your identity in the heavens, I'm speaking figuratively, about the dangers to our planet, about what's the future of our solar system and beyond. And then, you know, in the course of doing both the short-term emergency and long-term mission-based economy building for our nation and with other nations, you forget all of the spin-offs. That sounds practical, but I don't mean it that way. During the 1960s of the Moon Program,
that's the right kind of practicality, Marcia.
That's it.
Because the point is, this argument that we can't afford it is a completely fallacious blocking out of what reality is. We couldn't afford the Intercontinental Rail System, except look what it did for our country. We couldn't afford the moon mission. Look what it did for healthcare, computers, and things of that sort.
And, you know, I have a homely example that I was inspired to think about from Diane's remarks, that some of the downsizing of the NASA and other programs had engineers go off in a niche and try and work on things. Some of them went down to Florida, and they developed ways to have electron beam treatment of sewage. Now, Diane, I looked up the Passaic Valley sewage system, and it's in big trouble.
Oh, no. Yes.
I'm afraid. Hudson County, Bergen County, because they're asking everyone not to flush that often because the sewage treatment system is so bashed it can't deal with it, right? But, in fact, anywhere we want to go, if we want to treat pollution, China has a big problem, a lot of people, not enough water. But you can have electron beams. We should be in the isotope society. So I think that's what the moralizing sense of we have to be human in reacting to this terrible storm, but to the tasks we have ahead.
And Diane, when are you going to officially announce your campaign, besides earlier in the show?
Well, I'm writing a statement now, which will be available early next week, but I'm thinking of having some kind of event a couple weeks from now, because there's a whole number of interesting people who ran for office and elected officials who've been following LaRouche's webcast in New Jersey. So probably in a couple weeks, I'll have an official event launching the campaign, joined by a lot of these people.
Well, anyone in the greater New Jersey area, you should start setting aside some time to work on this campaign, and don't wait till July or August or September of next year. We're going to need a mobilization to get to the people who are losing their hope right now and have lost everything, to say to them, you do have a recourse, you do have a candidate. And Marcia, I want to thank you for joining us today. Again, I would encourage every one of our listeners to go to the EIR website and get Marsha's article on the reality shock for the course of the nation, and think about how you can use these ideas about the fact that we no longer have a functioning U.S. economy to mobilize your friends and your neighbors and your coworkers, because we're, as Mr. LaRouche is pointing out, we didn't even talk about the war danger today, but we're on the verge of losing civilization because of the kind of idiocy, the kind of short-term thinking which says we can't afford to do the things that 50 years ago we did without even thinking, because we knew that's what civilization needed. So Marsha and Diane, thanks for joining us today. We'll be talking to both of you again soon, I'm sure. And thank you for joining us on the LaRouche Show today. We'll be back as usual next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And also, you can look on the LaRouchePack.com website to see Mr. LaRouche's discussion last night in the last of his first round of Friday Project broadcasts on forecasting. So until next week, bye for now.
Thank you.
Thank you.